This week, National Book Award winners celebrated. Meanwhile, employees at college bookstore chain Follett Higher Education Group consoled hundreds of colleagues who were pink-slipped. Welcome to Copyright Clearance Center's podcast series. I'm Christopher Keneally for Beyond the Book. On Saturday, November 23rd, at the 30th Annual Miami Book Fair International, Oren Tyker, Chief Executive of the American Booksellers Association, lays out the landscape of the new world of book publishing and bookselling in the wake of the Apple ebook price-fixing case. I'm proud to moderate that discussion in Miami at 2:30 with my regular Friday guest, Andrew Albanese, Publishers Weekly senior writer and author of The Battle of 999. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Andrew.
Greetings, Chris.
Well, we're looking forward to seeing you in Miami. We'll talk about that in just a moment, but let's start with some good news. We have National Book Award winners.
That's right. And in Monday's issue of Publishers Weekly, we'll recap what was a wonderful night at the 64th National Book Awards. More than 700 members of the book community had gathered, and congratulations go out to Cynthia Cadota, who won for The Thing About Luck in the Young People's Literature category, to Mary Sivist for Incarnadine in poetry, to George Packer for The Unwinding in nonfiction, and to James McBride, who won for his novel The Good Lord Bird. Also on Monday's issue, we have a great piece by Judith Rosen as to why fewer college students are unlikely to actually buy these great books at their campus bookstore. You mentioned Follett in your introduction, and that was the big news last week, that Follett was laying off a chunk of its worst workforce. Of course, Follett services a lot of these campus stores. And in Monday's issue, Judith Rosen looks at how trade sales are falling at college stores and why that is. And I'll give you a hint. It has something to do with the rise of online selling and a new device market. Why go to the campus bookstore when you can get your textbooks on the iPad? And if you're not going to the campus bookstore, well, you're probably not going to be buying that new bestseller, are you? So there are many ways in which digital is affecting sales, and this is yet another one of them.
Well, in fact, we're going to be talking about all of that, as I mentioned at the start, in Miami on Saturday. Look forward to seeing you there. Oren Tyker from ABA, the American Booksellers Association, is going to join us a very interesting talk.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a great talk, too, and I'm really looking forward to it. We're going to talk a lot about the landscape of bookselling and in the wake of the Apple litigation, and there's a lot to talk about there. But I'm just going to say this for now, and, that's that, the publishers in 2009 may have believed that their biggest problem was Amazon's low prices, and that's why they entered into this deal with Apple to use the iPad to sort of blunt that and give them back consumer pricing control. But what I really want to know is, what was their solution to the change that the iPad was going to bring? One interesting fact in my book, The Battle of 999, is that at the time that the publishers actually entered into this deal with Apple, they had not seen the iPad or the iBookstore. In fact, there was no tablet out there. And I think it's clear to me now that the tablet has brought about a much bigger challenge than Amazon really did with its $9.99 prices. Consider now that you're competing for consumer attention on one device. That's with movies, TV, games, web, YouTube, you name it. It's all on one device competing for your attention. So if publishers thought $9.99 was too cheap in 2010, now they have to make the case that their preferred price, which is $14.99, is the right price on a screen where kids can also binge watch hundreds of TV shows for $7.99 a month on Netflix, or get Angry Birds for 99 cents, or watch YouTube for free. So, I'm a reader, you're a reader, I know we both believe in books, but even if publishers did manage to use Apple to get back price control, they still were going to have to compete for user attention. The iPad has made that a more dicey proposition than ever, and I look forward to talking with you and with Oren about what publishers face in the future.
Well, you are so right. It's a rather depressing point, but just an important one to contemplate. Look forward to that discussion on Saturday afternoon, 2:30 at the Miami Book Fair. Andrew Albanese joining me with Oren Tyker from ABA. Well, last week we talked about the Authors Guild and how it took on the chin a ruling in the Google Book case that Google's practices were fair use. But fair use advocates this week had a little bit of rain on their parade. The 11th Circuit, in its review of the Georgia State e-reserves case, asked some tough questions. What happened?
Yeah, you know, it definitely was a reminder that fair use advocates might not want to, you know, celebrate before the final whistle blows in any of these cases, because the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals in Atlanta did indeed have some, well, I guess they were tough. I guess interesting, too, would be the word I would use. But they had some questions in their review of a May 2012 ruling in the Georgia State e-reserves case. By most accounts, it was a tough day for the GSU defendants. So, you know, a little background here for those who may not have been familiar with the case. It was first filed in 2008 by three academic publishers, Oxford University Press, Cambridge, and Sage Publications. These publishers alleged that a handful of administrators at Georgia State had systematically encouraged their faculty members to commit copyright infringement using Georgia State's electronic reserve and course content systems as sort of a no-cost alternative to course packs. Basically, what they would do is scan a copy of a reading, put it up on a secure server, and let the students come to the server and to read it. Ultimately, however, Judge Arinda Evans found there was infringement on just 5 of 99 counts in that suit. And in a 350-page ruling, she handed down some of the most substantial fair use findings in decades. She also rejected a sweeping injunction that was proposed by the publishers that would have, among other things, mandated extensive record keeping at Georgia State and allowed the publishers to actually go on and monitor the e-reserve practices at Georgia State. So the publishers were also ordered to pay GSU's legal fees. That's worth noting. They had to pay about $3 million to Georgia State. But they've appealed, and they're claiming that Ms. Evans misunderstood and misapplied the law. And they argue that she basically ignored the forest for the trees here, that she ignored this great pattern of infringing behavior that Georgia State was using in sort of eliminating course packs, by undertaking this really microscopic copyright investigation of each individual infringement. So enter the 11th Circuit this week. And Duke University's Kevin Smith has a really detailed write-up of the arguments. And he says that they were bizarre. And bizarre in a discouraging way for fair use advocates. Most discouraging, he noted, was that the 11th Circuit seemed to accept that e-reserves were in fact some sort of market replacement for the printed course packs of the past, and that they might in fact require permissions like those course packs did. And if that's true, that could be a big blow for educational fair use.
Well, Kevin Smith is a colorful commentator, to say the least, but he hardly uses words like bizarre carelessly. What does he mean, bizarre? Why were the questions bizarre?
Well, bizarre in terms of, well, there's one moment he notes on his blog in specific where Judge Marcus from the 11th Circuit had actually questioned GSU's contention that, you know, fair use applied to the works here because the works were informational. That's the applies to the second tenet in the four-factor fair use test, the nature of the work. Marcus asked if that meant that Darwin's The Origin of the Species, which is one of the most important books in science, should lose its copyright because it was fact. You know, you could practically hear Smith's jaw hitting the floor as he considers that statement. You know, first he notes Darwin's book had already lost its copyright because it's been in the public domain for a long time. And yet he writes, science writing has gone on. But he goes on to note that the very importance of Darwin's masterwork is, in fact, an argument for fair use, not against it. You know, if educational access to Darwin's book was dependent on having to pay a publisher a fee every time an excerpt was going to be used in an educational setting, that would really harm scientific education. The question Marcus should have asked, Smith adroitly observes, I think, is whether copyright protection was a major factor in Darwin's decision to write the book in the first place. You know, so I'll leave you with one major thought on this, and I'll encourage people to go to the Kevin Smith site and read his take on this. And that's that even if the appeal is overturned on decision and, you know, fair use is sort of scaled back from the original decision, this case still strikes me as kind of a loser. And the reason why is that even if they do prevail, it's only likely to push forward the advocates of open access. You know, I certainly understand the principles that the publishers are seeking to uphold when they first undertook this suit, but I really do question the practical effect of suing their best customers over e-reserves. Certainly, there could have been some compromise that they could have come to here rather than let this all get fought out in court. And we saw how that turned out for everyone in the Google suit. So to me, you know, it seems like the risk risking the whole pie for the few crumbs of fair use that are left on the table. But you can read more about this on Kevin Smith's site and on the Publishers Weekly site, where I'll be following up in the coming weeks.
Well, intriguing analysis, as always, from Andrew Albany, senior writer at Publishers Weekly and the author of The Battle of 999. We'll see each other in just a few hours in Miami at the Miami Book Fair. Andrew, thanks again for joining us on Beyond the Book.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it, and have a great trip down.
Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs, as well as images, movies, and television shows. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, find us on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at beyondthebook.com. Our engineer is Jeremy Brisky of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.